Talk with Mike Colomeco has been brought to you by Cento, Calavita, and Wines of Portugal.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey folks, welcome. This nice chilly January day here in Morgantown, Bushwick, Brooklyn. Got a great show coming up today. We have three wonderful guests, a couple New York icons, one specifically Mimi Sheraton, who's, what can you say about Mimi Sheraton that hasn't been said? She's really one of the great leaders, pioneers, trailblazers in the food industry in terms of food writing, cookbook writing, book writing. Food critic of record for many years, the New York Times, broke the glass ceiling there back in the day. She's got a great new book out, 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die. Then we're going to have Charlie Palmer in. Charlie is a chef who's been around New York for, well, there's not a lot of people that I can say this, but a bit longer than even I have. He blew up way back in the day at the River Cafe, which was Buzzy O'Keefe's launching pad for American talent when almost every other kitchen back then was run by Frenchmen. So Charlie's going to talk about what he does in New York these days, what he's doing in California, but we'll probably concentrate in New York. And then we're going to go to Stephanie Sachs, who's got a great book out. She is a, she's got a lot of initials after her name, MS, CNS, CDN. I don't know. She'll explain all that to me, but she knows a hell of a lot about food and ingredients. And the name of her new book is What the Fork Are You Eating? It's great. It's about how to avoid all that junk in the supermarket and an action plan for your pantry and plate. One quick shit up before I go to Mimi. We were at Tuesday afternoon. I was at a tasting of the just released Brunello 2010 vintage. We had a master of wine leading us through the tasting. I think we had 9 wines altogether. If you're not familiar with Brunello, you should be. It's one of the great Italian wines. Sangiovese is the grape. Brunello is a very specific typicity due to, like all wine regions, elevations, soil type that varies throughout the little mountain range, exposure. But what I can tell you as a takeaway is the 2010s are extraordinary. It was one of those great years for winemakers when all the stars lined up. The wines we tasted were spectacular, and the styles changing in Brunello's away from what had been sort of bigger, heavily tannic wines. With kind of funny acidity to wines now that are much easier to drink. Still big, still huge, still tannic, but a much different style of wine than the Brunellos I remember from a decade ago. So if you're looking to spend a few dollars soon on some great wines that you can cellar or drink now, the 2010 Brunellos were extraordinary. Let me get to my first guest and enough of that. Mimi Sheraton, great to have you out here.
Oh, it's lovely to be here, back in my home borough.
Which I didn't realize till I read the book. So I've known you, not known of you. I came to New York in 1982, right out of the CIA, as a kid that didn't know a bupkis about New York City. I was from Philly, and I just knew I wanted to be here because the Philadelphia restaurant scene was almost non-existent outside of Le Bec Fin, and New York was New York. It called me. And back then, you were the food critic, which was, I didn't realize it then historically, contextually, because what did I know? But all I knew is Mimi Sheraton on Thursday night at midnight, when he came off your line shift, you picked up the New York Times and you'd read who got the Friday review and what it was. And so you've always been this icon for me. And then I was lucky enough at one point to accidentally be your neighbor when I was living on Abingdon Square. And I'm, wow.
Overlooking the wonderful Green Market.
Right overlooking the weekend Green Market, which I was rarely around for because I bail down to Cape May on the weekends, but I was there a few times. Would walk past your house all the time and say, well, this is where Mimi Sheraton. How cool is that? But let's get to the book. So the title of this book, it's out in paperback and hardback, is 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die. At best, I mean, as I read this book, I was floored because I'm almost 60, and I spent my whole life in the business as a chef, as a young cook, for a while as an importer in between, and now with the PBS show, I'm out to eat all the time. I travel to Europe a lot, and I thought, I've eaten a lot of stuff. And I opened this book, I'm like, dude.
Well, I have quite a few years on you.
No, but you just so go back
more than a generation.
Go back to your, because I didn't realize. So you're a Brooklyn native.
In fact, this neighborhood close to Williamsburg is where my grandparents emigrated to, and where my parents grew up until they met and married and moved to Flatbush, to the Midwood section. But I lived in Brooklyn until I was 19. And then I moved into Greenwich Village, and I've never left. This is my 70th year in Greenwich Village.
the changes, I don't even want to talk about. I'll bellyache about how I've seen New York change in the 3 minutes I've been here, which is almost 40 years worth. But, yeah, that's fantastic. But and your dad was in the produce business.
Yes, he was, in the old Washington Market. And that was, I think, part of the way I developed a certain sense of discernment, because he had very strong opinions about which products from which parts of the country were better than others. It was always grapefruit from the Indian River in Florida, which is in 1,000 foods to eat before you die. Not grapefruit from California. On the other hand, oranges from California, but not from Florida. He had all these opinions. He would talk about what came in to his company from all over the country every night on trucks. And he liked the celery from California. He didn't like the celery from Florida. And most of what he said has still played out. I still think East Coast apples are better than West Coast apples.
Which is in the beginning of the book. And I was cracking up because, once again, I'm like, really? I didn't know that West Coast oranges weren't as good, or better, excuse me, than Florida. Well, and I've had those Indian River grapefruit. And they are just, once you've had those, it's like, why bother eating another
and
one?
And I like them white. I like white grapefruit, and that's the entry in this book. Not pink ones specifically, and there's a wonderful mail-order shipper of them. I tried the mail-order things anonymously. I tried them as Mrs. Falcone, my married name. They didn't know it was going to a food writer with a book. I also ordered in season their Georgia Freestone peaches, which were, you know, so much for locavore. I like the peaches I get at the local green market, but given my druthers, I would eat Georgia peaches every time.
And you have these references in the book, so we should describe the book as it's laid out, because I was thinking, well, 1,000 foods, that's not so easy to wrap your head around. And for you, it was winnowed down from
almost
2,000 or 25.
Almost 2,000, right. and in the course of the 10 years that it took me to do it, because I did some other things in between, new things began presenting themselves. And I wanted the model for the book, I must say, the thing that gave me the idea was its predecessor, also published by Workman, 1,000 Places to See Before You Die. Mm-hmm. I was at a dinner party seated with Patricia Schultz. She gave me a copy of the book, and then I went home and thought, I wonder. And then my husband said, you're out of your mind. Do you know what you're getting into? Right. It was, you know, like stepping in chewing gum. So I gave it a couple of weeks. I know it's going to be horrible. And then I called Peter Workman, and I said, I have this idea. He said, come on in. Some of the editors were there, and we started. And we thought it would take 2 years, but one of the things that made it take much longer was that every single thing in the book is available one way or another.
Which is one of the great so I'm reading it, and I'm kind of good doing my speed reading, going as fast as I can. And then I'm like, wait, slow down. Because at the end of every single entry, it could be a reference to a dish. And you'll say, if you're in New York, here's a restaurant that does this.
Right.
If it's an ingredient, here's a couple of websites where you could sell it. Here's a few more. I mean, it's this
Or a recipe. That I examined many and found the one I thought best for the dish in a cookbook and online.
Right.
So one way or another, you may have to go far away to get it, but it is someplace. And I say in the introduction to 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die that it's, in a way, my autobiography.
Yeah, it is.
Because for the last 60 years, my life has been made up of going in search of food. I have said that one of the things that I had a mad love of travel always, and I think it went back to a nursery rhyme book, Robert Louis Stevenson's Child Garden of Verses, and the poem that begins, I would like to rise and go where the golden apples grow. And I think all of my life I have been rising and going in search of golden apples. And the adventures and the friends I've made and the things I've learned aside from food, because of food. And I would like people who have this book not only to get the foods and try them, but to think it's a good read. As a writer, I would most like someone to say it's a great read, because there are, I hope, interesting side aspects to food about cultures and religion and superstitions and weirdness. I mean, there are some things in here, even the editors at Workman said, you don't really mean people eat that. And I said, yes, I really mean people eat that. But it's a kind of maybe developing a bit of tolerance, a bit of curiosity, whether you just want to read about it or whether you really want to go out and find it. Or if you're taking a trip to some place, you might want to refer to the book and see what is interesting in food to try there and where to find it. There are a lot of great markets in the book, which I consider a great food experience. And I have drawn some of the 1,000 foods to eat before you die from literature and paintings and movies. There was a wonderful book by the Brazilian writer Jorge Amado called Gabriela Clove and Cinnamon about a cook and how she went to the market near Bahia and what she bought and what she made. And that was the food of Brazil. So that's in the book. And Eleanor Clark's great classic, The Oysters of Loch Mariaque, about the Brittany Bellon and their history and their customs. So I suggest that if you really like oysters, you take a vacation in January or February when the water is coldest and the oysters take best. Walk on the beach, the Atlantic beach in Brittany, in a heavy sweater, and a few times a day duck in and have some oysters, read the book there. So there is a lot, and there are also movies, the cook, the thief, his wife and her lover, and the marvelous mozzarella and carozza sandwich that figured so much in the movie Bicycle Thief.
Yeah, which wasn't so much about food. It was rather bleak and black and white and sad. And
there was
food.
Eating the sandwich and the stringy cheese, and his father is sitting there thinking, how am I going to pay for this? Because he didn't have money.
Right.
And those things lodge in my mind when I think of certain foods. So I hope that comes across, too.
You had an editor once point out that, I don't know if it was a he or a she, but it almost seemed as if your food writing was kind of an excuse to get you traveling, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
It was I have an idea. I want to do a story on capers. Maybe that'll send me to... Let's do a story about anchovies or sea salt. And it would be great if I could fly to...
Southern Spain, and I did.
Right.
He was a very, very wise man who said, you know, you're one of these people who looks like she's doing one thing but is really doing something else. And he was absolutely right. And capers were a perfect example of what got me to southern Spain, how they're grown, how they're hard. I mean, an interesting, legitimate story, but it got me where I wanted to go.
And this was during your tenure at the time?
Yes.
The Times? Okay.
Yes.
Because you were how long? You started in...
I was there 8 years.
As the food critic.
I became the food critic 6 months after I joined the Times.
Oh.
I became the critic in July or August of 76. I got there in December 75. And John Cannaday was the critic, and he took a vacation 4 weeks during which I reviewed, like in March or April. And when he came back, he said, because he was also the art critic, and he did this as a side thing, he said, you're more serious about this. I'm going to step down. And we asked him to stay a few months so I could build up a backlog. And he was a very gracious gentleman, and that's exactly what he did. And when I was finally named the critic, all of us in the department, then the Times was near Times Square, sent out for hot dogs from Nathan's to celebrate. One of my favorite foods.
Hey, and another great New York story, the original. That's the original.
Yeah, Nathan's used to be right there in Times Square.
That's right, back in the day. So Again, the name of the book's A Thousand Foods to Eat Before You Die. The author is my guest, Mimi Sheridan. And it is, I mean, I think what you just said is great because there is no story of food without the culture that surrounds it, without the people involved with
Absolutely.
It, without how it moved from this space to that space. I mean, you think of potatoes and tomatoes, and what were they cooking in Italy before they got tomatoes? I have no idea. But this is there's this whole broader picture, and I think you get that in here. And you're all over. You're in South America. You're in Asia. You're doing Korea, Japan, China, African cuisines, North African, Sub-Saharan. I mean, it's huge.
Well, I was quite interested in exploring West African cuisine in New York on 116th Street. There's this wonderful restaurant called Africa. I don't know if they say kine or kine. And I began with a friend. We were eating all of this Senegalese food, and it was different ingredients, different seasonings, but the overall aspect suggested Louisiana cooking. And, of course, so much Louisiana cooking was created by slaves from West Africa, who, in fact, brought the word gumbo with them, which is okra in Bantu. And it was very evident. And I think, now, here's a cuisine, if handled right, could become part of the fusion, could go mainstream. So it was, in a few cases, a very good lesson for me, too. I have said that I have had 90% of the things in the book, leaving 10% that I can still aspire to, my reach still exceeding my grasp. So I have something to look forward to.
Well, it's a great read. And even travel advice. It was funny. I'm going to the Philippines in a couple of weeks. I've never been there before and don't know about the culture. We're going to find out. We're going to be there for a long time, 2 weeks with cameras all over, running around islands. And so having not been to that part of the world, I go to Europe all the time. I'm like, maybe I should go to the Centers for Disease Control and see what I need. My doctor's like, yeah, you're coming in. And there was hepatitis A, this, that. So I'm already on those protocols. And you have that stuff in here. You
right.
have that kind of
it's
advice.
Street eating especially.
Right.
I'm
and
a
you
big
have that guide
street
about
eater.
How you don't eat this, you don't drink water unless you crack the cap on the
right.
bottled water. And
And I'm not talking about the currently fashionable food trucks. I'm talking about the real street eating, the real native vendors who do the food of their country. I think one has to worry less. In a food truck. They're inspected there. But I'm very, very careful, and I too have the vaccination against hepatitis A because I'm very likely to eat raw shellfish, and that's the dangerous one. But
yeah, that's true. That's one of the, in terms of foodborne illness in America with seafood, that's like 80% of it is
right,
clams,
right.
oysters, and maybe mussels.
And you
clams
don't
and
know
oysters.
Where they were fished from,
right.
what kind of
right.
waters. So it's, I did a story long ago for the New York Times travel section on the night food markets of Beijing and Xi'an, where I ate locusts and silkworms and
back in that's crazy, right?
And
this was before
marvelous,
Andrew Zimmern was a glam in his parents' eye even an idea.
They had a wonderful specialty called frogs on a stick, and that's what it was. Little teeny, but whole. Never mind frogs' legs. This was the little eyes and the little heads and the whole thing. But everything was done over such high heat over charcoal that everything tasted like ashes, which may have been a blessing in the case of locusts and silkworms.
That's hysterical. What a life. So back in those days, you were traveling that much. You were just living on airplanes.
Yes.
You get that sense from your books.
I had some wonderful experiences. The first issue of the Condé Nast Traveler, Harry Evans asked me to fly around the world in as many airlines as I could, business class, and report on the meals. I had to have a major meal on every leg. And
what a gig. Excuse me.
It took about 2.5 weeks, and I stopped in a few places to do stories there. But it was really, you know, I went from New York to California to Hawaii, to Tokyo, to Hong Kong, to Sydney, to Singapore.
Around the world in business class. Back then when it was kind of a deal, I mean, there was what was the food like back then on an airplane? Was it better?
Well, now they don't even do food.
I know. I don't know what they do now. I mean, even in, it's don't even talk about flying now.
Remember,
it's
this
like
was business class,
truck.
And some were very good. United was very good from Tokyo to Hong Kong. The best, I think, was JAL. At that
Japan
time.
Airlines.
And I had to try and get both meals because there would be like a European meal and a native meal. And Harry said, you have to get both meals. So I would order steak on the American one, and then I would say, it's too rare. Could you bring me the other meal? And I had a camera. I had to photograph every meal. So I had a Polaroid. I had to learn how not to photograph my lap, how to focus it on the tray of food.
That's too but funny.
It was a wonderful, wonderful adventure.
Well, your entire life has been a wonderful, wonderful adventure.
It really, really has, and I owe it all to food.
Well, on that note, folks, if you don't get this book, you're nuts. I get so many books sent to me, and 99% of them end up at the Strand. I'm just like, take them, whatever. You know, recipe books that don't work, stuff I don't care about, some blogger that blew up for 3 minutes somewhere in the country and decided to write something on casseroles. And then this book comes, and first of all, I know the author, and I'm like, okay. And then I start to read it, and if this book isn't in your library, in your cookbook collection, you're a fool. Mimi Sheraton's the author. It is just such a wonderful story because it's a distillation of arguably one of the richest lives one could imagine spent in the space of food and travel and food writing and dining out.
I'm grateful to it, and I've loved being here with you.
Mimi, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming out to Morgantown.
Thank you.
I know it's a schlep, and L Train, or however you manage the car service, whatever. The name of the book is 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die. This is one book you should read before you die. In fact, just read it now. Go to Amazon and order it, or buy it wherever you buy your books. Mimi Sheraton's the author. It is great. It's rich, and it's full of links and cross references. You just can't put the damn thing down. It gets you stoked, and it gives you an idea of how great her life has been and still continues to be.
Thank you, Michael.
So much for coming on. My next guest is going to be Chef Charlie Palmer. He'll be here in a minute. We're going to take a quick spot and a shout out to some of the people that bring this show and some of the other shows possible here. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, and these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece, and that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, handpick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey folks, Mike Calameco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon
Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy. But what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants, wherever I was hanging my chef's toque, and that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. Like, I keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you stop by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too. We're back. Who was that, Liz? That was good. That was good. I like that one. Play them again. That's some local fifth grade class, it sounded like. All right. So Charlie Palmer was going to be my next guest, but he'll be my last guest today. We bumped him. He's eating pizza at the bar. Let him be comfortable. So my next guest, my current guest, is Stephanie Sachs, who has a great book, just came out, What the Fork Are You Eating? An Action Plan for Your Pantry and Plate. The truth about what's hidden in your food. Over the years, when I used to do broadcast at WOR, I would get David Kessler, I would get, you name them, anybody that was writing in this space of sort of navigating the supermarket, navigating our lives, what are you supposed to eat? And this is a great book. This is right to that. So, Stephanie, explain to me, after your name, you have MS, CNS, and CDN. For someone like me that barely got out of high school, what does that stand for?
I joke that I should add ADD and OCD to the end of that.
That's all I would have after mine.
Right. So, I have a master's in nutrition from Columbia. I'm a chef, actually, trained at the Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts in New York City. And I graduated in the late 90s. And then I went off to Columbia and got a master's in nutrition. And then further certifications as a certified dietitian nutritionist and a certified nutrition specialist.
So we live in this funny time where Americans are finally, I mean, I'm an old guy, almost 60 these days, and I lived through the 60s and 70s, and I kind of remember what the food scene was back then, which was like off. It was the worst. It was the end. It was the supermarkets took over. Fast food was it. TV dinners were considered acceptable.
Yes.
Why drink orange juice when the astronauts drank Tang? I mean, I remember people, that's what people, literally, that's how people lived. You got this orange powder that who knows what was in it. You stirred it around and it tasted like poop and you drank it and that was it. That's where we were. And now we've sort of gone 180 degrees into a culture of farmers markets, of locavore, of 24/7 television, food TV, that section of the bookstore is growing, wonderful people like Michael Pollan contributing to these arguments.
Yes.
And yet there's this like disconnect. So
absolutely.
Talk about this, because what I love about your book is it's kind of, not kind of, it's a great tool for the consumers out there. It's not about diets. It's not about that. But it's like, okay, here's what you want to avoid. Here's what you want to get rid of. Here's how to shop and read labels.
Right.
And then here's how to cook, including recipes. Here's how to plan weekly dinners that you can do. But let's kind of start in the beginning, because it's really, I've been in the food business all my life. So
who oversees, describe to us what the USDA, Department of Ag, and the FDA do in the space of food.
So when it comes to food, actually, there are three regulatory agencies that we're looking at, and it's the FDA, and it's the USDA, which really deals with animals and crops, and FDA is more packaged foods and drug regulations and a lot of the ingredients that go into food. And then you have the EPA, which is focusing more on the quote-unquote toxic substances that go into our food and what are the allowable levels, so as in pesticides. So
smiling already.
I know.
This cracks me up because, okay, it's going to be like the Wizard of Oz. Now let's open the curtain.
Right. So it's quite comical. And I want to preface this by saying that I don't like to live in the world of food fear and food problems because it's actually very scary. And the problems are so big. They're so much bigger than any one of us. So this book is really about solutions and trying to help people in a nutshell, because it is in a nutshell. As you know, Michael Pollan has written multiple books about problems with our food system, as has Marion Nestle.
Yep. Another New York great NYU.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And they really break down so many of the problems. So has Winona Hodder with Foodopoly. What I'm trying to do is distill a lot of that information into really usable, navigable tools and give people the things that they can do at home. But for people to be able to shift what they're doing, they have to start to really understand that our food is not effectively regulated. And that's a really hard thing to get your head around because you think our government is here to protect you. But the bottom line is that our government is so closely married to food industry and big ag that the likelihood of your food being protected in the way that truly puts your health first is slim.
Yeah, to none.
And so that's why what I'm trying to do is inspire people and give people the tools to become their own advocates, because there are ways to eat healthfully from a day-to-day basis, okay, not going so farm to table, which definitely can have an elitist spin to it, where people on food stamps can eat healthy and people in any socioeconomic scenario can eat healthfully. And I have the great honor of working one-on-one with so many people, and people who live in the projects to people who live on Park Avenue. And I can honestly tell you that the common denominator in the 15 years that I have been working one-on-one and teaching groups is that people want to do better. But nobody knows how. And how can you? You turn on the Today Show and you see nutrition experts talking about healthy breakfasts. And then you see, you know, a sugar-filled, trans-fat-filled Skippy peanut butter flash across the screen. And a lot of these interests of these health professionals, you have to start to question. Are there interests in our health?
Right.
Or are there interests in the money that they can earn by supporting certain products? So there's a very fine line that we you know, have to walk.
And here, then labeling. I mean, you start out with this whole thing, and I've been in this business all my life, and I was in food manufacturing. I know what you're saying. I mean, we leave so much of this leap of faith. We're going to trust the industry to police itself.
Right.
We don't have plant inspectors going around in the country.
No.
All the imported stuff that comes in is illegal. None of those containers get inspected. I mean, the really big companies that are responsible will send out a plant auditor if you're going to. I mean, and I hate to say this, but some of the biggest, or maybe some of the best, like a McDonald's actually sends if you're going to send potatoes to them or apples to them, you've got to. But having said that, the food that makes garbage at the end of the day. But you start out with all of that, and then we get into the food labeling laws, which are funny. And they're nonsense. Like what you
can say.
Well,
there are no food
labeling
laws.
So you have this whole section where what does it mean, like if they say local or if they say.
Right.
You have a whole section that just debunks food labeling. There
well,
is none.
Right, because they're actually. It's funny, and it's actually quite comical because. Our government defines most, actually, of the terms that you see on food today, everything from cage-free to natural to antibiotic-free, pasture-raised, grass-fed, but
yep.
They don't regulate anything. So companies are left to their own discretion to pick and choose what they want to slap on their products.
So locally grown means nothing. There's no verification.
There's
natural
there's,
means right. nothing.
Oh, natural is the biggest joke.
Natural is huge. Because I'll see these chickens, and I know we're coming out of Purdue. We're coming out of one of the big Tyson or one of the big two. And it'll say something, and you just know they're flat out lying. Naturally raised. Verification. No. No additives means nothing. No.
Nothing.
Even in the world of chicken, back to them, like fresh. No, it's frozen. It's like it's actually they can lie.
Right. They can lie. And the only way that they can be caught in a lie, quite honestly, because the regulations and the inspections are so loose, is if consumers go to the Federal Trade Commission and, you know, bring a product's attention to the commission. So Rice Krispies in 2011 had a big banner that said boosts children's immunity. And I mean, who in their right mind
believe any of this.
Thinks
right.
that
Rice Krispies are going right. to contribute anything to an immune system of anybody?
I mean, it's absurd, but unfortunately, yeah. I work with people who believe that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I try not to judge. What I try to do is inform. And so Kellogg was sued for, I think, over $5 million. And that's a long, laborious process. So what we're seeing, thankfully, is we are seeing companies, smaller companies, that are taking more responsibility. But as a consumer, the big question is, what can you do? And that's why I had to write this book.
So talk about it. Because one of the great – so Michael Pollan wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, and I read that, had him on the radio. At the end of the interview off mic, I said, so, dude, do you cook at home? So, I mean, so fill me in. Because yeah. now that this expose has shined a brilliant light on – what's the solution? Well, then he comes out with In Defense of Food, or whatever that was called, and talks about shopping the perimeter of the supermarket. So you pick that up, because that's my, when I'm asked this, when I'm in front of people, that's what I tell them. Just don't, the middle aisles, leave them alone. The canned, the frozen, the processed, the pre-made, leave them alone. If it has more than five ingredients, don't go there. Just shop dairy, fruit, vegetables, protein. How do you, what's your take?
Well, no, I mean, I fully believe that, and I think that that is ideally the way to go. But I consider myself a realist, not an idealist, because I work with people who aren't going to be doing that all the time and who aren't going to be cooking all the time. And there are many barriers that prevent them from doing it. So my job is to meet them where they're at. And so what I try to do is say, okay, if you're going to do canned foods, let's do canned foods this way. And if you're going to do frozen foods, let's do it this way. If you're going to pick seafood, these are the things that I want you to think about. If you're going to pick animal foods, oh my God, let's talk about these things. And so what my readers can do is pick and choose the different tidbits of information that they can use in their own lives that make sense for them, because not everything makes sense for everybody. You know, I was asked last night, I did this Enlightened Eaters book club, the James Beard Foundation with Slow Food and Natural Gourmet. And someone said to me, what do you eat? You know, what's your diet? And am I a vegetarian? And I said, no. I said, actually, I would be a vegetarian if my body didn't crave animal protein. But the bottom line is my body does. And so I feed my body what it needs. I'm just very particular on how I source my food. Mm-hmm. And it's my choice. I don't, you know, we don't live a lavish lifestyle. I don't drive a fancy car. I don't have a huge home. I live in a cottage. My boys sleep in a bedroom together. You know, my husband and I are both really hardworking people. But we have chosen to spend our money on food. Because in the end, that's what matters. So we're not going on vacations all the time. We don't get to do a lot of the things that people around us do, because I will not compromise on how I buy food. And people's values around food choice need to change, or we're going to get sicker. And so what this book really does is answers that question. You know, Michael and Marianne put out such great information in their books, but where they left us was, how do we take this information now and how do we actually make it so practical and
synthesized
usable?
Synthesized into our lives, which is what you're doing here with Monday through Friday, lunch, dinner, how do we want to eat, breakfast,
exactly.
lunch, dinner. Here's some snacks. Here's the stuff you can do ahead. It's pretty much lays it on your lap to say, hey, just follow this. It's not as hard as you think. Here's how it works.
Yeah. And so, you know, I break down, you know, the issues in the first section, go into pantry rehab,
right.
help you clean out your pantry. And
right.
then we go to the grocery store, and then I take you into the kitchen.
Right.
And we do 50 recipes. the joke is I actually pair all the recipes so people know how to make meals. And I don't drink, and so or I rarely drink, so I know nothing about wine. I heard you talking about wine earlier.
I drink.
Yeah, so I know nothing about wine, and so but I pair food.
Yeah.
So I have food pairings. So if people say, "Oh, great recipes," but I don't, how do I make a meal? Well, there you have it.
Yeah, it's great. It's a really, I mean, as I said, you weren't listening, but Mimi's book, I get so many books that which in this media, we just get sent all this stuff.
And
I put them in my trunk. I bring them to Strand and I say, give them away, sell them, whatever. They're nonsense. They're contributing nothing but useful information. This book was great. It's so nice.
Thank you.
It's a great, you have a great voice. It's great. It's practical. The name of the book is What the Fork Are You Eating? Stephanie Sachs has been my guest. It's a great read. I mean, again, what this radio station is about and what this show is about is really to try and get good information out there to the people in this world of food. In America, we actually have kind of a global audience with Heritage these days. And this is just, this really nails it. You got it. Great, great
thank
book.
You. Thank you. Thank I you. Really appreciate
you can,
it.
You it's, can sense your passion and it's wonderful.
It's a labor of love and pain.
Hey, like everything else that's worthwhile is, Stephanie Sachs has been my guest. Again, What the Fork Are You Eating? It's a great book. Get it. Help can take control of your diet and your families. We'll be right back with Charlie Palmer this time. I promise you, he's here. He's on his way in. Stay tuned.
This is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner. Jesus, everybody does the Barry White thing. Okay. This is Mike Calameco, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. My next guest is going to be Chef Charlie Palmer. Stay tuned. Chef Charlie Palmer, welcome, brother. It's so great to have you here. You've never been out here before. I never had you on the radio. Because I guess when I was doing WOR in 06, 07, 08, 09, you were on the West Coast a lot back then. That was kind of home base. Or I couldn't figure that. I hear about you from Frankie Crispo whenever you were here. But it seemed like you were out
everything
there.
Everything he tells you is a lie. So
hey, easy with Frankie. What year did you come to New York? 70 what?
I came to New York in 79. Yeah, from the CIA.
One of your great mentors was Dannon's.
Leon Danins, yeah, yeah.
I remember Belgian, him. Belgian guy, lunatic, great guy.
Yeah, yeah. Great chef, yeah, really.
Great chef. So the New York of 1978, Fezziguez at Caravelle, Jean-Jacques Rachoux at La Vendue, Saltner's at Lutèce. I remember the whole list of maître cuisiniers. We all had that little book, who was there. But it was all French guys running the kitchens.
Yeah, it was the French mafia back then, you know.
Your first job?
My first job was at La Côte Basque. Yeah.
With
I mean, I started
JJ.
At La Vendue, yeah, just briefly because La Côte Basque wasn't ready to open yet, exactly. But, I mean, talk about a couple of months. And then I was part of the opening crew at La Côte Basque, the redo of La Côte Basque.
Which was the first time, and to Jean-Jacques' credit, I'd love to get him out here on the radio, but I've got to call his cell and see if he picks it up. He's a hard guy to get a hold of these days. But he was seminal because he was the first French chef who was top tier. Those restaurants were all three-star, considered the best in the city. He was the first guy to give American cooks a chance as full-time line cooks.
Yeah, and I think he was convinced early on that, you know, the American guys coming, especially coming out of the CIA, were the future. You know, he kind of saw, I think, that changing in the guard and kind of like that regime change kind of thing that was happening and was a little bit out in front of that, you know.
Totally out in front of that. Yeah. Because, I mean, as I was working at the Four Seasons in 82, but I knew all – I met Frankie Crispo at the gym. He lifted weights. Right. I was hitting a heavy bag. And we all kind of talked. We were all in the same world. It was such a small town back then.
Right.
There were not a lot of restaurants. There were not a lot of cooks. It was kind of one, like, neighborhood in the East 50s where everybody worked.
Yeah.
But the other French chefs wouldn't hire. It was French guys. Whether they were good, not good, we didn't know. But if you were American, it was just no way, not full time. He was the guy that broke that mold.
Yep.
Huge, seminal guy.
He was good. And you know, and a lot of us that worked at La Côte Basque early on, if you worked, you know, as a fish, if you were the fish guy in the morning, if you were poissonnier in the morning, you know, in the summertime, a lot of the French guys would go on vacation for like 6 weeks.
Right.
You know, they'd go for a long time and stuff. And, you know, there was always the opportunity. And the chefs talked to each other like, I need a poissonnier for, you know, 3 weeks at Le Chantilly. I worked at Le Chantilly. I worked at Lutèce for a while.
Because the skills are interchangeable. The menus were very similar.
Yeah.
Dover sole grey, Dover sole meunier.
Right, exactly.
Back then it was kind of like one menu, rack of l'impersiade or whatever.
Yeah.
And the skills, and it was a brigade system, so that you knew you were entremetier, you were légumier, you were poissonnier, eventually you were saucier, which is big deal. But the skills were malleable. You could move from kitchen to kitchen with that same skill set and do
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, you were part of, I know Andrew Friedman's in the midst of writing a great book. I'm glad someone's going to write this because it's kind of about that. It's about the New York restaurant scene in the 70s and 80s, which was really the beginning of the rise of the American chef.
Yeah.
When you came to New York, there were no American chefs. There was no guy in a kitchen, which it gets me to your next spot where you kind of came on my radar, which was Buzzy O'Keefe, brilliant guy. Has this little restaurant that he built on a barge underneath the Brooklyn Bridge called River Cafe. Larry Forgione was the original chef, doing stuff so far ahead of his time, American menu, American ingredients, listing that on the menu. The buffalo comes from here. My asparagus comes from here.
Right.
Really celebrating American cuisine at a time when it didn't have a name or even exist outside of maybe the West Coast, maybe. And what he was doing here. You were at the River Cafe right after him?
Yeah, I came after. Larry had left the River Cafe. And I had been actually up in Westchester. I left La Côte Basque. I was in this really exclusive golf course, you know, country club situation, which was great for me. I mean, there was people like, well, what did you do at this golf course? But I could literally do anything I wanted. And a lot of that at that time was really about – I grew up on a farm in upstate New York. And, it was about, like, sourcing ingredients. And I was getting really interested in – and I had traveled to France a couple of times at that point – to say like, well, you know, if they have all this amazing stuff in France, you know, why can't we have it here?
Which was that was in all of our heads. By then, all of us had gone to France.
Right, exactly.
And we're like, we'd fall in love with the food, and then we'd come home and be like, fuck, it's a Cisco truck again. Or it's a shit off the plane. It's, why can't I get these ingredients? Why is there a disconnect?
Right. And so by the time that I met Buzzy O'Keefe, and it was a long process, you know, he was looking for the next chef at the River Cafe, and, you know, And finally made it, you know, finally came to the point like he trusted me. I think at that point, you know, and Buzzy didn't know at that time, like I was 23 years old.
Wow,
you know?
You were 23.
I was 23 years
that's
old.
Amazing.
He ended up finally hiring me. which is a bizarre situation. I love Buzzy O'Keefe, but you know, it's nothing is ever clear about what's happening. You know, but anyway, so I began as a chef. I put together my team. You know, at this point, Larry had left the River Cafe, and you know, there was a, you know, not that it was not happening, but you know, things were kind of adrift, you know, like what was happening at the cafe. But anyways, I put a good team together of all young American talented, you know, chefs, a lot of them CIA chefs coming out of school. And I'll never forget. And you know, when we started to really see success, and you know the restaurant was really operating well, and you know, it was getting some really good
reviews, yep,
you know, accolades, yep. And you know, not just reviews, but also like attention from, to me, it was always important, the attention that we were getting from the culinary community.
Other chefs.
You know, when Daniel Boulud was coming to have, you know, dinner at the River Cafe because he wanted to see what was going on. Or, you know, some of the French chefs were coming to the River Cafe because that's where this, you know, American food incubator kind of thing was happening. To me, that was really important. And chefs from Europe coming to New York to come to the River Cafe to say, like, well, what is happening here? And, you know, to me, that was just sensational. I mean, I remember Jean-Louis Paladin came
up
to see me.
He was such an amazing guy.
Yeah. But, you know, he wanted to, you know, he's like, I wanted to see what you're doing.
He's always been that way, too. Yeah. He's always been, so many chef friends of mine, Frankie DiCarlo at Peasant talked about the first time Jean-Louis ate there. He recognized him. And then Jean-Louis came back with, you know, Daniel Boulud or Paul Bocuse. And these guys, when they found something they liked, they were really attracted to it. They got it. They understood.
Yeah, and at that point, I had a young guy that was working with me, and he became like really we call him the source guy. Like his job, besides being one of the sous chefs, was to go find these people, go find people that would produce things for us.
Ingredients.
You know, ingredients for whether it was raised chickens for us, raised ducks for us, grow vegetables for us, forage mushrooms for us. You know, like that was his job, and it just kind of, you know, kept. It snowballed, you know, and we had all these people coming to us and really having some people come up and say, what would you like me to grow for you?
That's a first.
You know, and that was revolutionary.
Yeah, that was. In the early 80s, that was the beginning. California was starting to happen then, but they were different. That's a different restaurant scene. It's a different farmer culture. That's kind of the first in New York. Yeah. So today, what do you oversee? What's the empire? I mean, I have just lost track. How many properties you have? What in California right now?
In California we have, and I say we because we really are a team of people that work well together and you know and think together too, because it's important that we're all on the same page when we're doing things and you know projects that we think are smart for us as a group.
And I should segue. After the River Cafe, Oriole was the next restaurant, which is really your stepping out.
Oriole was my first restaurant.
That was your restaurant, townhouse, east, whatever. I remember the room.
Yep, 61st.
And that was huge. I mean, Oriole was you hit it over the fence. That was a great restaurant, had great reviews, and had a long, still to this day is running. Not in that location, but now you're on 42nd Street.
Yeah, yeah. No, in California we have in Healdsburg we have two hotels. And restaurants. Hotel Healdsburg, which is the main hotel, is right on the square in Healdsburg. Dry Creek Kitchen is our restaurant there. It's a really, what I call, northern Sonoma-centric restaurant. Like, for instance, our wine list is exclusively Sonoma bottlings. And it's the most comprehensive collection of Sonoma wines in existence. I mean, you know, we have upwards of 600 selections of only Sonoma wines. And, you know, because my view is, I want that restaurant to be about the location. You know, I compare it to like if you go to Tuscany, you want to taste and drink the wines of Tuscany. You're not going to drink, you know, wines from Piemonte, you know, when you're in Tuscany or
no,
you know, or
completely
same
always
thing.
The way
so,
it's been. Yeah.
So to me, it's all about that, and it's all about where you are. You know, you're in this amazing place. You're surrounded by growers. Artisanal cheesemakers. Petaluma, California, which is 20 miles away, was the poultry capital of California for many, many years. Now it's more central California. You're 20 plus miles from the coastline. you know, where, you know, king salmon, Dungeness crab, all those things, lingcod is all.
Which is interesting because this goes back, if you go back again to your travels through Europe and mine in the 80s, you'd go to Auberge de Lille and your little town near Colmar, and there's a family that's been running it forever, the Aberlins, and you were drinking the wines of the region, the food of the regions, the geese, and then you'd go to Georges Blanc in Vona, just outside of Lyon, and they had that model. But in America back then, all the great restaurants were in cities. In cities.
Exactly.
There was no idea. So that was another disconnect, which you'd go to Europe and you'd drive to these towns where the population was like nothing.
Yeah.
And somewhere there was the 3-star Michelin restaurant, Relais and Chateau, Maseratis, helicopters, where people traveling to it for that experience. So that's what kind of you're doing now with that property.
Exactly. And it's like, and it's really, you know, it's that restaurant is really, I want it to be about the community too. I want the local wine community and people, and it's 2-3 generations, you know, deep of people that have lived in Healdsburg. And let's face it, these are farmers. First and foremost, they're farmers. They grew grapes before they ever made wine. But I want them to be comfortable in this restaurant too. It's not just a tourist restaurant. It's not just a restaurant for our hotel guests, which are traveling obviously from wherever, the East Coast, Dallas, whatever, you know, wherever they're coming from. But really be inviting to the local clientele, because I think that's what really makes a restaurant like that magical, when you have that combination of local Healdsburgers, people that live there or, you know, have weekend homes there also, or they live in San Francisco or the Bay Area, combined with the transient hotel guest that's coming there for a wine experience, you know, and they're tasting the wines of the area, and literally at the next table there's a winemaker sitting there that makes those wines. Mm. That's what makes it special. Mm. And, our team and, you know, we've been incredibly successful at doing that and keeping it at a level that's like, you know, my goal at Dry Creek Kitchen is to have a Michelin star, you know, not two, not three, but have a Michelin star, but really have a restaurant that's foremost, you know, inviting, you know, and polished.
Accessible,
but really,
delicious. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
you've really come back to New York in a big. I mean, it was just me, or was I opening up the New York Times this whole fall and Florence's column? And I'm like, what the F? Charlie's back. I mean, how many openings have you had in the city?
I mean,
in
we've always
not that you've ever left. I mean, you've been here forever.
Exactly.
So I mean, we forget that. I mean, Oriole's been here since the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, that was Steve Zolas in the early days, and you were in orbit, and you've stayed there.
Yeah.
So it's not like you've left, but now suddenly there's more presence here. What you just you're doing a steakhouse, the old Rothman space. I was there the other night.
Yeah,
great party. Food was wonderful.
Right. Well, we've had, you know, we have three other steakhouses.
You have one in Vegas, right?
Yeah, we have in Las Vegas, we have a steakhouse in the Four Seasons, Charlie Palmer Steak. We have in Washington, D.C., we have a steakhouse that's literally across the lawn from the Capitol, 101 Constitution. And then in Reno, Nevada, in the Grand Sierra Resort, we have a steakhouse. And we also have an Italian restaurant called Briscola, which Crispo won't stop busting me about, you know, what are you doing Italian? But,
Frankie,
you know, I always wanted, you know, it's very simple, but very good. Very, you know, we do house mozzarella. We make our own, you know, we do all the things that Frankie does. Maybe not as good as Crispo.
Easy.
He is the man.
He's the man.
So, but we certainly try hard, and it's, you know, well accepted. People love it. But anyways, to get back, I had never had the right opportunity in the right location for that matter to do a steakhouse in New York City, you know, and, you know, I think we found the perfect location. It's an amazing location.
Steps off Fifth Avenue.
Right.
A good, 54.
Good size. It's not a big cavernous thing. It's
right.
really, it's
seats
really,
100,
it's about 120 seats.
That's what it looked like. Because it had a back room that I didn't step into.
We have a private room that's amazing. It seats 30 people. That's truly a private room, which I think, especially in a steakhouse, is really important. You know, there's a lot of people that want that private room experience, whether it's a business thing or social. It's got a great bar, you know, which is a prerequisite, especially for a great steakhouse. And, you know, and it opens up to the street, which is an amazing thing, which is unusual in a steakhouse. And we've done it in a very kind of modern, you know, contemporary feel. So it's the kind of thing that's, you know, very refined. Very simple, because when you talk about steakhouses, you know, it's really about sourcing amazing ingredients.
Yeah.
You know, really sourcing the best stuff you know, and really treating it properly in the kitchen. You know, it's not about creating the next
culinary wonder.
Amazing.
No.
Yeah.
So it's about, I mean, I've had this in my head. I mean, the American love for steakhouses, it's one of the few idioms we invented that's part of our culinary DNA.
Yes.
We invented the diner. We invented maybe the hamburger. But the steakhouse precedes all of them. And you go back to places like Keene's and Peter Luger's and the old Homestead in this town of ours. They go back to the late 1800s.
Yes.
When New York was cutting a third of America's beef was being dressed in the meat market district. Yep. It's just part, there's something about the celebratory aspect of a large cut of meat, that format, yep, a large cut of meat, a bottle of wine, potatoes, comfort food, good sides, vegetables we can, yep, wrap our heads around. That's what you're doing.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
Great meat. Who are you getting your meat from? May I ask?
Yeah. We deal with a number of different, okay, people. We do a lot of our sourcing comes from DeBragg and Spittler, and I have, you know, obviously a, you know, 25-year relationship with Mark. So,
and we all knew Mark and his dad.
Yeah.
Huge.
And, you know, I would still say DeBragg is the preeminent dry aging facility. You know, there's that whole big misnomer about dry aged beef. You know, who's really dry aging everything? DeBragg and Spittler is doing it and doing it right. And
they built a new facility in Jersey that's huge.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got $1 million of beef hanging there in rooms with fans blowing and air moving around at 34 degrees.
He's controlling the humidity.
You can smell the funk when you walk in. It's the shit. It's the best. It is. And that, I mean, as much as I love organic and free range and all that, there's something about corn-fed, prime, dry aged that just, hello.
Yeah. I mean, for certain things, that's what people are looking for. The other thing is, I think, that makes us unique is we really source, you know, some interesting things. And when I say that, you know, we always have true A5 Japanese Kobe beef in-house, you know, and on the menu. A lot of people talk about that, but they really don't have it, you know, all the time. That we always have that in-house. And people want to try it. You know, and we're in a location where a lot of times money is no object. It's about they want to have the best. American Kobe, you know, which I think, you know, to me is great value because, you know, it's very, very good. Is it Japanese? No. No, it isn't. But it's an amazing, you know, some of these things like Imperial Ranch, the stuff out of Nebraska, which I've developed a relationship with over the years. I used to source it, you know, directly from, you know, from the processor. But now they have distribution in New York, so it's a little bit easier. But, you know, interesting cuts and something where if somebody wants to come into the restaurant and try something a little bit different, I mean, these are super rich cuts of meat. I mean,
we talked about that. It's like foie gras. You're not eating a whole lot of it. It's so rich. I mean, it's so fatty. It's texturally, it's just 3 ounces, 2 ounces, and you're good.
Yeah. But our Snake River Farms are doing a phenomenal job. So we feature some different cuts. So when, you know, people want something a little bit different, of course we have an amazing dry aged ribeye. We do a New York strip that's 28 days aged on the bone prime, you know, which is, you know, that's what some people, that's what I want kind of thing. And of course, you know, filet is always a big seller in the restaurant. But and then we, you know, and I think what separates us as a steakhouse is the refinement of service. Like a good example, like we talk about, like we conduct service in the steakhouse like we do at Oriole. Yeah. So if you order a glass of wine, it's poured at the table, you know.
Exactly.
And I think those little touches, a lot of people get that level of service and why it's different, you know, why it's executed like that and what, you know, that's what makes it special.
Give us the address again as we've got to wrap up the hour.
Yep, it's now 5 East 54th Street.
Steps off 5th Avenue, between, north side of 54th.
Yeah, between 5th and Madison.
Charlie, great to have you, man. You've been a great part of the modern American culinary scene, one of the breakthrough American chefs, of the first generation of American chefs that did that, that stood up on their own. You go back to the days of David Boulay, preceding Tom Colicchio.
Sure.
Ann Keller. I mean, you were there at the beginning. Congratulations on all of your success. Right. It's been great to watch you over the years. And I don't know how Frankie Crispo got you, me, and him in that little thing he has, a little police interceptor.
The meter maid car.
If you don't know what Charlie Palmer looks like, he's like 6'3 and 250 pounds. I'm not a little guy, and Frankie Crispo has never been known as svelte. And somehow we got 650 pounds of man into that space and drove from somewhere to somewhere one drunken night. Anyway, that was a long time ago. Great to see you. Great to have you here.
Great to see you.
Thanks for coming out to Bushwick. Charlie Palmer Steak. One more time, the address?
5 East 54th Street.
Great.
Come see us. Great steak.
Thank you. Very well. Folks, you listen. We're going to have great guests next week. I've got Arianda Gag coming out. I've got 3 guests next week. I can never remember who they are. But they're all going to be good. A guy that wrote a book on Spanish salumi. He's coming in from the West Coast. And my third guest, who I can't remember. That'll be the last show for a bit because I'll be in the Philippines. So I hope you enjoyed this one. We'll see you all next week.
for Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is Real Long Way to Go by Brothers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.